This is amateur hour, and it needs to stop.
Well, good luck with that happening. Hey, welcome to amateur hour.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. To the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. In Lanchester, Pennsylvania, on WW News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico, on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNH, and Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, up in Seattle on KODX. Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Just trying to hang on for dear life from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast, as Donald Trump has blinked, just as he almost always does. He has backed down on his dumb, ill-considered, wildly damaging tariff threats before even one full day of them going into effect was over. On everybody, at least except for China, on whom he actually raised tariffs a little bit higher. Still, proving that it was his actions and only his actions that have been tanking the stock market and the U.S. economy over the past week. The major market indexes skyrocketed within minutes, perhaps within seconds, of his announcement that the White House was, yes, backing down from the worldwide tariffs, except against China, but also everywhere else, where he's still leaving in 10% tariffs for now. I'll explain that in a bit. But backing down on most tariffs.
Yes, except for the ones that he never did install at all on Russia.
Right. Yeah, for some reason.
Can't imagine why.
Don't know why. They didn't get any. But anyway, yeah, he's backing down on all of the tariffs for the most part, sort of, that he had threatened just 1 week ago during his laughably ridiculous, clownish, so-called Liberation Day announcement in the Rose Garden. What a complete joke this guy is. At least if he weren't so dangerous, as I will need to note again here momentarily. But anyway, more on all of that somewhat, sort of, kind of brighter news for a happy change in a bit. We'll see how much I ruin that for you when we get to it. But before this matter gets lost into the news madness of Trump's dumb on-again, off-again, mostly off-again tariff regime, the upcoming battle over the Trump GOP budget showdown in Congress, before we stand down ourselves next week with Congress for a much-needed spring break and all the rest of the blizzard, I kind of want to follow up a little bit on my conversation yesterday with Slate's legal journalist Mark Joseph Stern. If you didn't hear the interview yesterday, I would strongly urge you to check it out. It's available for free via bradblog.com and all of the podcast sites, etc. But in the spirit of the old Nazi-era post-World War II poem by the German Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller, first they came for me, I kind of want to underscore what happened over the past 24 hours at the U.S. Supreme Court, especially since the liberals on the court themselves actually cited the Nazi era abuse of the legal system. You know the poem. First they came for the socialist, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. So, let's try very much to not make that mistake, shall we? To that end, Mark Joseph Stern and I on yesterday's show had both sort of come to the agreement sort of from different places that the 5-4 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday night in the Alien Enemies Act case had indeed left the door open for Americans, American citizens, not just migrants here, but U.S. citizens to be swept up off the streets by the administration and sent to foreign gulags where, according to the right-wing majority court ruling, we would be entitled to no legal redress whatsoever, no due process of any kind, according to the Supreme Court's own ruling. And it seemed absurd when that idea first became clear to me as I reviewed the SCOTUS ruling on Monday night, so much so that I kind of needed to touch base with our friend Mark Joseph Stern to make sure that I was not overreading that decision somehow. And as you may have heard in my conversation with him yesterday, it sounds like I wasn't overreading it. He seemed to concur pretty much 100%. About this dangerous ruling coming out from the court. But of course, that was just the two of us, a panicky progressive radio and podcast guy like myself, a lefty-ish legal reporter from that Slate.com outfit.
And don't forget your loyal producer over here who thought the same.
Oh, definitely. The lefty green news lady, as you've been called. Surely we were all just, overly panicked or trying to scare you for radio ratings or something or other. And of course, I even checked myself on that matter, as I sort of noted on the show after my conversation with Mark. But if there was any doubt of whether he or I were sort of overreading that decision for the menacing possibilities that it seemed to be handing to the Trump administration, this op-ed today in the New York Times headlined, "We should all be very, very afraid," written by two of the nation's top legal minds, Erwin Chemerinsky, the dean of the law school at UC Berkeley, and Lawrence Tribe, the emeritus professor of constitutional law at Harvard. Their op-ed may help end any such questions about whether Mark and Desi and I were all overreacting. Both men, by the way, have filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court in the Abrego Garcia case. I'll get to that in a moment. But they write, of all the lawless acts by the Trump administration in its first 2.5 months, none are more frightening than its dumping of human beings who have not had their day in court into an infamous maximum security prison in El Salvador, and then contending that no federal court has the authority to right these brazen wrongs. In an astounding brief, they write, filed in the Supreme Court on Monday, the Solicitor General of the United States argued that even when the government concedes that it has mistakenly deported someone to El Salvador and had him imprisoned there, the federal courts are powerless to do anything about it. The Supreme Court must immediately and emphatically reject this unwarranted claim of unlimited power to deprive people of their liberty without due process, the two constitutional law professors argue. They continue, that would seem to be the obvious response. It was Thomas Jefferson who called the right of habeas corpus to protect against unlawful detention one of the, quote, essential principles of our government. Jefferson's concerns are underscored by the case of Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, a lawful resident of the United States whom the federal government admits it wrongly deported to El Salvador. He has been incarcerated in El Salvador along with some 200 Venezuelan migrants deported there last month by the Trump administration, which says they were involved in criminal and gang activities. On Friday, Judge Paula Sinis of the United States District Court in Maryland ordered Abrego Garcia's return. In a subsequent opinion issued on Sunday, she wrote that, quote, there were no legal grounds whatsoever for his arrest, detention, or removal. His detention, she added, quote, appears wholly lawless. Now, Abrego Garcia, he was the man who was born in El Salvador. He came to the U.S. to escape persecution by violent gangs. He was given protective status by a U.S. immigration judge. Back in 2019, he married an American citizen with whom he has a 5-year-old autistic son, and last month he was snatched out of an IKEA parking lot in front of his own son and shipped off to El Salvador in what the Trump administration now admits was, oops, an error. But they've been unwilling to actually do anything to get this man back, to get him back out of that violent gulag in El Salvador where he is jailed with some of his persecutors that he had tried to escape back in 2019. Back to Tribe and Chemerinsky. One might think that the Trump administration would at least try to correct its grievous mistake by attempting to secure Abrego Garcia's release through diplomatic channels. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, has been called, quote, a great friend of the United States by Marco Rubio, President Trump's Secretary of State. But no, the Trump administration does not seem willing to lift a finger to fix the calamity that it created for Abrego Garcia and his family. Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, responded to Judge Sinis' order by saying that the judge should contact President Bukele because, quote, we are unaware of the judge having jurisdiction or authority over the country of El Salvador. She sniped. Her suggestion that a federal judge play the role of a diplomat rather than provide legal relief to Mr. Abrego Garcia is unworthy of any presidential administration, they argue. Why hasn't the Trump administration acted to secure Abrego Garcia's release? After all, he is there because of a government screw-up. The answer can only be that it is using this case to establish a truly chilling proposition that no one can stop the Trump administration from imprisoning anyone it wants anywhere in the world. In its brief to the Supreme Court, they write, the administration argues that the only remedy available to a person in custody is a writ of habeas corpus, a court order that a person in custody be brought before the court to determine if the detention is lawful. But the administration also contends that federal courts have no authority to issue such a writ when the person is held in a foreign prison, as is the case with Abrego Garcia. There can be no doubt what this means, they argue. Again, not me and Mark Joseph Stern, but Erwin Chemerinsky and Lawrence Tribe arguing this. There would be nothing to stop the government from jailing its critics in another country and then claiming, as it is now, that the courts have no jurisdiction to remedy the situation. Armed with this power, the government would know that Immigration and Customs Enforcement or the FBI or any federal law enforcement agency could apprehend anyone, ignore the requirements for due process, and ship them off to El Salvador or any country that would take them. These individuals would have no legal recourse whatsoever from any American court. The administration could create its own gulags with no more judicial review than existed when Stalin did the same thing in the Soviet Union. Which, yeah. That is kind of the point that Mark and I were trying to make in our discussion yesterday. Anyone, doesn't have to be even a migrant, lawful here or not, undocumented here or not. It could be a regular old U.S. citizen like me or Mark or, yes, Desi Doyen. Judge Zinnes ordered the government to return Abrego Garcia by 11:59 p.m. on Monday. The Supreme Court paused that order on Monday to allow the justices to review the matter, but it should not take much time for the court to conclude that every minute Abrego Garcia is wrongly incarcerated is a minute too long. The Supreme Court also handed down a ruling on Monday in a case involving the Trump administration's mid-March decision to remove non-citizens in the U.S. who are members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, supposedly, without any hearing at all. Five Venezuelans went to court to block the president's plan, and a federal district court judge did exactly that. But roughly 200 Venezuelans were deported anyway, despite the lower court's order that they must not be until they receive a hearing before a court to determine whether they meet any bar for deportation. The administration has argued that if it needed any authority to take that action beyond the power inherent in the presidency, such authority could be found in the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. But as Judge Karen Henderson of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia explained in a March 26 decision concerning the deportations of those roughly 200 Venezuelans, that 1798 law was limited to formally declared wars or imminent military invasions of the United States. Until the Trump administration, the law had been invoked only three times, they note, during the War of 1812, World War I, and World War II, when it was used to intern Americans of Japanese ancestry. That action has since been all but universally condemned as a shameful overreaction to the attack on Pearl Harbor. By invoking the Alien Enemies Act, the esteemed law professors explain, the government claims it can circumvent the usual procedures for deportation, including due process. In an unsigned opinion, which the Supreme Court handed down on Monday night, a 5-4 majority with Justice Amy Coney Barrett joining the three liberal women in the minority, said that the Trump administration could continue to deport Venezuelan migrants using that 1798 law. Which is absurd, as I've noted, as the plain text of that law says it can only be used to detain and deport citizens of nations that have formally, quote, declared war on the U.S. or in the event of, quote, invasion or predatory incursion ordered by a state government. None of that has happened in this case. None of it, even as the administration has claimed that migrants coming into this country amount to an invasion. But not by the government of Venezuela. I mean, the Venezuelan government did not order an invasion of the U.S., in case you're wondering. In fact, most of those Venezuelans were here in the U.S. because they were trying to escape the Venezuelan government. But the Supreme Court majority on Monday, they write, also said migrants fighting deportation in this case could challenge their detention, though only through habeas corpus petitions, which it said needed to be filed in federal court in Texas, in their case, where they were held, not in Washington, D.C., where the government officials who made the decision on their fate are, and where the case challenging their deportation to El Salvador was based. The court said these individuals should be given notice and a hearing before being deported. But as for those who have already been deported to El Salvador and imprisoned there, it is troubling that the court did not speak to whether they can get any relief from any courts. The justices did not answer critical questions like, can the government use the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 at all in this matter? Did the lower court have the authority to issue the order to stop individuals from being taken to El Salvador? Is there any legal basis for the Trump administration to put individuals in an El Salvador prison? And, crucial to Abrego Garcia's pending case, will the court reject the Trump administration's claim that no federal court can hear a habeas corpus petition of someone who is being held in a foreign country? Sorry, Kilmar, You should have never been deported. You had rights, but you lost them, apparently, because we screwed up and sent you away. Too late, too bad for you, Kilmar. The esteemed legal professor's note, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, identified how much is at stake. Quote, "The implications of the government's position are that not only non-citizens, but also United States citizens could be taken off the street, forced onto planes, and confined to foreign prisons with no opportunity for redress if judicial review is denied unlawfully before removal." She said, "History is no stranger to such lawless regimes, but this nation's system of laws is designed to prevent, not enable, their rise." Well, it used to be. "If the government can disappear anyone it wishes," they write, "dump him in a Salvadoran dungeon and prevent any court in this country from providing relief, we should all be very, very afraid." That, according to law professors Erwin Chemerinsky and Lawrence Tribe in the New York Times on Wednesday, sounding very much like Mark and I on Tuesday. So, yeah, I am very, very afraid in one sense, and so should you be, about all of this, which is why I kind of wanted to underscore this matter before it's, you know, overtaken by the next dumb comment by Donald Trump at a news conference, even though, frankly, I do not enjoy frightening anybody. But I think it's important for you to understand what is going on here before it is too late. And as the 1946 poem goes, "Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me." So, yeah, we are speaking. As we go to air, we are still awaiting the Supreme Court's decision on whether the Trump administration has to try and retrieve Abrego Garcia from that El Salvadoran dungeon in his home country. Apparently, the argument given to the Supreme Court by the administration was so obnoxious and filled with so many lies that Abrego Garcia's lawyers asked for permission to file an additional reply to it to set the record straight, which I understand they have now done so today. So we'll see when we get that ruling. Hopefully it will be forthcoming, and hopefully it'll be better than the horrors that they issued on Monday night in the Alien Enemies Act case. Though, speaking of which, the point on which all of the members of the Supreme Court did agree in that ruling on Monday was that those to be deported under the act must be allowed time to challenge their deportation in court, at least those who have not already been shipped out under the act. Though only the five men on the court declared that such challenges must take place where a migrant is detained, which is mostly in Texas right now, where the federal courts are very right-wing MAGA, as we also discussed yesterday. Advocates for several of the Venezuelan nationals swept up by Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act, who have not yet been shipped off to El Salvador, swiftly went back to court after the Monday ruling from the Supremes. In the most prominent case, two of the original plaintiffs filed a new lawsuit in the Southern District of New York, seeking class action status for all the similarly situated migrants and asylum seekers. In a twist, the two plaintiffs, who had almost been deported on the on that March 15 flight, those flights from Texas, had subsequently been transferred back to New York, which allowed them to file their lawsuit there instead of in the right-wing courts of Texas. But today we got a bit of surprisingly encouraging news, especially out of the Texas court. Federal judges in both New York and Texas on Wednesday took legal action to block the government from moving five Venezuelans out of the country until they can fight the government's attempt to remove them under the rarely invoked law that gives the president the power to imprison and deport non-citizens in times of war, which this isn't. The men were identified by the government as belonging to the Venezuelan Trendaragua gang, which lawyers dispute. The three men are being detained in a facility in Texas, while two more are being held in an Orange County, New York facility. One man in Texas is HIV positive, and he fears that lacking access to medical care would kill him if he were deported to El Salvador. But the order in Brownsville, Texas, was particularly noteworthy in that U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez Jr. blocked the removal of any person held in El Valle Detention Center in Raymondville, Texas, who could be subject to Trump's proclamation invoking the Alien Enemies Act. Here's the interesting part. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez is a Trump appointee.
Hmm.
That's helpful. He also blocked any transportation or relocation of such persons outside of Willacy and Cameron counties in Texas without a court order. To prevent the government from moving the detainees in order to find maybe a friendlier judge somewhere. So the order is, in effect, to not move these men until 5 p.m. April 23. Judge Rodriguez scheduled a hearing on Friday to consider whether to extend the temporary restraining order or to issue other forms of emergency relief. He said he issued the order preventing their removal so that the plaintiffs could develop, quote, a fuller record for the court as it considers their request for a preliminary injunction and other relief, just as a judge is supposed to do, even though this one was appointed by Donald Trump. He also said he issued the order, quote, to prevent the immediate and irreparable injury that may occur with the immediate removal of any Venezuelan immigrant who may be subject to the president's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. Good for him. Thank you, Judge Rodriguez. The judge in the New York cases, Judge Alvin Hellerstein, a Bill Clinton appointee, he appeared set to issue a similar ruling up there in New York. He said those detained within the Southern District of New York must be given, quote, appropriate or proper notice and a chance to challenge the government's allegations in court. Quote, given the history, Hellerstein said, clearly referencing the previous cases and the Supreme Court's horrible ruling on Monday night, quote, it seems that they need to be protected and given the opportunity before they are deported. Thank you, Judge Hellerstein, as well. The lower court judges seem to be holding up. Can't say the same for the Supreme Court, who's doing some really, really scary stuff right now that you need to know about, at least until it changes. All right, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with some, it's certainly better, certainly brighter news. It's almost as crazy, but anyway, yeah, we'll come back with the crazy roller coaster on Wall Street as Donald Trump has, yes, backed down. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I don't know if it's a roller coaster of love.
Oh, definitely not of love.
But it's a roller coaster. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com.
More like insanity.
Make sure you're buckled up. Keep your arms inside the car.
At all times.
Donald Trump back down again on Wednesday, as he almost always does, mere hours after his enormous tariff sanctions went officially into effect just after midnight Tuesday night into Wednesday. Again, against almost every country in the world, friend and foe alike, except for Russia, for some reason. And the markets facing their fifth day in a row of brutal losses on Wednesday suddenly sprang back to life within minutes of the announcement that Trump was issuing a supposed 90-day pause in the unprecedented tariffs that he unveiled just last week to much fanfare, and thereafter trashing the U.S. and world markets and U.S. and world economies ever since in the bargain. Trump's post on his failing social media site hilariously declared, based on the lack of respect that China has shown to the world markets, I am hereby raising the tariff charged to China by the United States of America to 125% effective immediately. Because what China did was raise their tariffs against the U.S. to match the tariffs that we had put on them. Precisely the tariffs that eventually became 104% that Trump had issued against them after they had previously increased reciprocal tariffs by 54% and then 50% each time to match Trump's raising tariffs against them. And I suspect that China will likely raise theirs shortly to 125% against the U.S. as well. Back to Trump's dumb announcement. At some point, hopefully in the near future, China will realize the days of ripping off the USA and other countries is no longer sustainable or acceptable. Conversely, and based on the fact that more than 75 countries have called representatives of the United States, including the Departments of Commerce, Treasury, and the U.S. Trade Rep, to negotiate a solution to the subjects being discussed relative to trade, trade barriers, tariffs, currency manipulation, non-monetary tariffs, and that these countries have not, at my strong suggestion, retaliated in any way, shape, or form against the United States, I have authorized a 90-day pause and a substantially lowered reciprocal tariff during this period of 10%, also effective immediately. Thank you for your attention to this matter.
God,
that's what he said. All right, so, first, that so-called reciprocal tariff of 10% is just nonsense. It is not reciprocal at all. He placed it on virtually every country in the world, except for Russia, whether they had any tariffs on U.S. imports or not in their own country. So it is not reciprocal. It is just a tariff. Second, where Trump says, quote, these countries have not, at my strong suggestion, retaliated in any way, shape, or form against the United States, that's also nonsense. In fact, aside from China, the European Union has, in fact, responded to Trump's tariffs with their own retaliatory measures. EU member states approved tariffs on some $23 billion worth of U.S. goods, targeting items like steel, aluminum, motorcycles, agricultural products, etc. So that's just another lie. That's just Trump, more Trump gaslighting.
But his MAGA rubes will believe whatever he says.
Because they haven't in any way, shape, or form retaliated. It goes a long, long way to try to really tell them that they really haven't retaliated. Yeah. Yeah, dude, they have. And it should also be noted that Trump received nothing, no concessions from any of these countries before he simply backed down with his supposed 90-day pause. Still, Trump's predictable collapse here, yet again, by the way, was all that the markets needed to immediately spike in response, underscoring that Trump, and only Trump, was the one responsible for collapsing the U.S. and the world markets and the economies with this impotent idiocy. There were no other factors involved. The economy in the U.S. had been great. Joe Biden left us with a fantastic economy until Donald Trump rode in and decided to collapse everything. As AP reported the news on Wednesday, facing a global market meltdown, President Donald Trump on Wednesday abruptly backed down on his tariffs on most nations for 90 days, but raised his tax rate on Chinese imports to 125%. The S&P 500 was up 7.8 in afternoon trading. It had been down earlier in the morning amid worries about Trump's trade war and whether it would cause a recession, as economists fear. But it spiked immediately after Trump sent the social media posting that investors have been waiting for. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 2,476 points, or 6.6%. In a week of wild swings, they write, Wall Street pulled off perhaps the most dramatic turn Wednesday, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average went from a loss of about 350 points on Wednesday morning to a gain of 3,100 points at the close. It all happened, again, in a matter of minutes, and the Dow ended up closing nearly 8% up. The S&P was up by more than 9%. The NASDAQ Composite closed nearly 12% up. Just huge gains. Shares of automakers, travel companies, technology giants, and retailers surged after sharp declines in previous days. Apple gained 15%. J.P. Morgan added more than 8%. Warner Brothers jumped more than 20%. Travel-related companies in particular skyrocketed, with United Airlines and Delta gaining 26.5%. And almost 24%, respectively. Norwegian Cruise Lines was up about 19%. These are unheard of numbers to rise in a single day. Quote, in this twilight zone week since the tariff slate was announced last week, this was the first sign that the Trump administration would back off quickly, said analyst Dan Ives of Wedbush Securities in a note to clients. Ives, by the way, had been a huge Tesla fan before tiring of Elon Musk's shenanigans. For the record, Tesla picked up almost 29% on Wednesday following Trump's announcement, meaning that Elon Musk made hundreds of billions of dollars today, thanks to Donald Trump. Ives noted that Trump did not remove the tariffs that he imposed on China. In fact, he claimed he was increasing them to 125% after China matched Trump's earlier sanctions. And said Ives that would still be an issue for companies such as Apple, whose phones could double in price to consumers here in the U.S. until Trump backs off of those tariffs as well, as I suspect he probably will. Traders may begin to realize that after Wednesday's irrational exuberance fades, as there will still, as of airtime in any event, be that 10% tariff, at least for now, placed on all U.S. imports, along with those 125% tariffs against China. So, yeah, you will soon be paying more than twice for pretty much everything, not just iPhones, but pretty much everything that comes from China, which is a whole lot of things. At least until Trump blinks on that as well. Why am I calling this irrational exuberance? Well, look, we ain't CNBC here. I do not usually cover the markets like this. But what happens here extends to everything else politically. The reason that Trump blinked in the first place is because of the trouble that these policies are causing elsewhere. For example, in getting his tax cuts passed in Congress, a Congress with Republicans who are beginning to rebel against him. Yes, Republicans. I'll try to get to that in a moment. But while Republicans will declare that, you know, Trump backing down was some sort of genius victory for him, he is the reality that will likely soon occur to those celebrating on Wednesday. They are going to realize that he is still holding the keys here, and that he can make it still worse all over again. It can fall as quickly as it raised on Wednesday.
Yeah, he's got the keys and he can drive it into a ditch at any time or off a cliff.
And it's still in the ditch, whether folks, whether investors have realized that or not. As economist Ernie Tedeschi notes on Vichy Twitter after Trump's announcement, quote, folks, he says, a 10% broad tariff on everything plus 125% on China is almost exactly where the 2025 tariff policy was this morning. It was just less concentrated on China and more weighted overseas. In other words, as someone else observed, quote, it's still the same as it was, just repackaged. Our wallets will still feel the hit. CNBC's Megan Casella reported, quote, the new U.S. tariff rate against our two largest trading partners, that would be Canada and Mexico, is now either 10% or 25% or 35%. And so far, no one I've reached out to at the White House is able to tell me which. Watching the market, observed Zach Bouchamp of Vox.com, and then looking at the underlying reality, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills, he said. Chris Hayes of MSNBC quipped on Blue Sky, you set the house on fire, watched it burn, and then lost your nerve and put it out. You now have a partially burned house. Good job. Still, the market gains for the moment were in fact huge. We'll see if they last in comparison to the past week of catastrophic across-the-board collapse in both the stock market and the bond market, which, by the way, is what I think one of the big factors that led Trump freaking out and backing down. The fact that the bond market, which is supposed to go up when the stock market goes down, well, the bond market was also going down. That's not supposed to happen. Oops. That's a collapse not seen in the market since, well, the last time that Trump was in office, when he miserably failed to oversee the COVID pandemic and helped crash the markets back then as well. He does this all the time. He's got a lot of experience at it. It is unclear whether Trump's own U.S. trade rep, Jameson Greer, even knew about what Trump ended up doing on Wednesday via tweet. As Greer was busy testifying before the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee, apparently at the very same moment that this 90-day so-called pause was issued on his social media site, after all of the Republicans on that committee had apparently left the hearing, as noted by an outraged Democratic Congressman Steve Horsford from Nevada, who grilled Greer about all of this madness and who, if anyone, was actually profiting from it.
If you came here knowing that these tariffs were going to be turned off, why didn't you include that in your opening statement? Why didn't you reference that as part of your testimony?
Well, I don't disclose my conversations with the president, sir.
These were specific questions we asked you all along. What's the strategy? These are real consequences for the American people and small businesses. I had a group of small businesses in my office earlier today talking about the impacts of these tariffs on aluminum and steel. This is amateur hour, and it needs to stop. What does this even mean for your negotiating strategy? How are you in charge of negotiation if the president is tweeting about this from wherever the hell he is?
The president was elected, and he runs the trade policy, and I advise him and execute his
trade policy. Who executes the trade policy?
I execute the trade policy.
Did you know that this was happening?
We have been discussing all kinds of...
And there's another member of the cabinet, Bessent, who just canceled coming to the Hill to avoid talking about the market because it's in turmoil. This in just days, because there was no strategy, there was no plan. The president chose to take actions that he didn't even have the authority to take. He's put our economy in disarray and near collapse. We have small businesses and Americans who are concerned about their well-being, people's retirement, people's 529 accounts went down because of this administration. We have people that are planning to send their kids to college this fall. People who are retiring whose benefits have declined. Is this market manipulation?
No.
Why not? If it was a plan, if it was always the plan, how is this not market manipulation?
It's not market manipulation, sir.
Well, then what is it? Because it sure is not a strategy.
We're trying to reset the global trade system.
How have you achieved any of that? But to enact enormous harm on the American people, which was our concern from the very beginning. Tariffs are a tool. It can be used in the appropriate way to protect U.S. jobs and small businesses. But that's not what this does. So if it's not market manipulation, what is it? Who's benefiting? What billionaire just got richer? And all the while, there are not even any Republicans left in this hearing. They all left.
Excellent question. And it is like taking crazy pills. But yeah, who benefited from all of this? I suspect we will learn more on that in the days ahead, which billionaires benefited. But we know that, Elon Musk made a whole bunch of billions.
Yeah, and we'll find out who in the White House who had access to this information before it was released took advantage of it. Who knows?
And
we'll see if the Department of Justice even bothers to investigate.
And who in Congress?
Yep.
Oh, the DOJ ain't going to be investigating.
Yeah.
You can bet on that. In Congress, I saw a report recently that Marjorie Taylor Greene had reportedly sold off a whole lot of stock just before Trump's original tariff announcements. So who else, bought the dip just in time to make billions on Wednesday after Trump suddenly lifted most of those tariffs? But all of this affects everything else. In the U.S. House, Republicans offered another reason for Trump to blink on those tariffs. Many of them are very unhappy about the budget deal that was passed by Republicans in the Senate to allow for massive unpaid-for Trump tax cuts to billionaires and millionaires and huge companies that will, despite the funny math that congressional Republicans are trying to use, will in fact blow yet another huge hole in the deficit, and they're trying to pass it as quickly as they can before they leave for a 2-week vacation starting next week. As Politico reported Tuesday night, before Trump backed down, mostly on his tariff idiocy for the moment, on Wednesday, headline, Trump faces a House Republican mutiny. First, they caved on the speaker election, writes Politico. Then last month, they fell in line on a budget vote and again on a divisive government funding bill. But now it seems House conservatives are ready to make a stand. Yeah, well, we'll see about that. Speaker Mike Johnson is staring down the most significant internal revolt that he has faced all year, one that threatens his own plans to advance the Republican legislative agenda, and one that even President Donald Trump has so far been unable to squelch, at least as of Tuesday night. Republicans may be liking him more by Wednesday night. We'll see. But as Politico notes, dozens of House Republicans are undecided or outright opposed to rubber stamping a Senate-approved budget blueprint for the GOP's domestic policy mega bill and an all-out whip effort from Johnson and his leadership team, including a private meeting on Tuesday between Trump and key holdouts, has only produced modest gains, they report. If Johnson and Trump can't flip most of them in the next 48 hours, lawmakers will start to board flights for a 2-week recess, denying the president a show of legislative progress as financial markets wobble over his tariffs. So, yeah, Trump apparently thought he better unwobble the financial markets as much as he could, I guess. Hard right members have bristled previously at Johnson's big legislative moves, but previous mutinies stayed relatively small and manageable. This time, the opposition is piling up and rebellion is seemingly in the air as deficit hawks across the Republican conference dig in to secure deep cuts to federal spending. Why? Well, because all of those cuts that Trump and Musk and the Doge bros have been doing, in truth, while they will hurt and, in fact, even kill millions of people, they don't actually amount to a hill of beans in the U.S. budget. All of those firings of people doing crucial jobs that we need them to do, it adds up to almost nothing, less than 1% or so of the budget. Those firings are just mostly meant for cruelty's sake because, as Adam Suhr said years ago, the cruelty is the point. It's certainly not to lower the federal deficit, because if that's what Republicans cared about, they would not be pushing another $4 trillion tax cut for their friends. What's also different this time, Politico reported last night, is how determined some members are to defy Donald Trump, who has repeatedly intervened at key junctures this year to help bring holdouts along. Why are they eager to defy him? Well, because they see him as greatly weakened by all of this tariff crap. Nonetheless, Trump piled on the pressure on Tuesday night at a gala dinner for the House GOP's campaign arm. But right now, says Politico, the holdouts are enjoying strength in numbers. Trump this week urged House Republicans to quickly greenlight the revamped budget. To his face on Tuesday, however, several said no. It represents a sudden end to Trump's honeymoon on Capitol Hill, according to Politico anyway, where he's held near absolute power over Republicans. Until this point, even the threat of a primary challenge or other political retribution has been enough to bring most GOP lawmakers in line. This time, however, fiscal hawks are determined to act on their deeply held beliefs in small government and make good on longstanding campaign promises to significantly slash federal funding. Trump, in a social media post on Tuesday, said he endorsed, quote, hopefully in excess of $1 trillion in cuts at the White House confab with GOP holdouts. But that, in fact, is a far cry from the $1.5 trillion to $2 trillion in spending cuts that the House conservatives wanted to mandate in the budget framework. So we'll see. Maybe there is a rebellion brewing. We'll see if it holds. We'll see if Donald Trump rolling over on the tariffs somehow earns him back some sort of power over this. But Congressman Rich McCormick of Georgia, another holdout here, estimated that there were as many as 40 House Republicans who are either opposed outright or undecided whether they're going to vote in favor of Donald Trump's central legislative agenda here at all. At the same time, as of Tuesday, as we noted yesterday, Senate Republicans were growing in their opposition to Trump's tariffs, with at least seven of them so far signed on to co-sponsor legislation that would remove his tariffing authority altogether, all of which has been, no doubt, part of his thinking in blinking, mostly anyway, on those tariffs on Wednesday. In the House, Speaker Johnson is similarly concerned about the likelihood of a majority to take away Trump's unilateral tariffing authority, which he has clearly abused, granted to him, by the way, in the first place by Congress, and therefore it can be immediately taken away from him by that same Congress. Johnson knows that a so-called discharge petition, if signed by a majority of House members, that would likely include all the Democrats and, you know, just need three or four Republicans, a discharge petition would, in fact, mandate a vote on a bill to remove Trump's tariff authority, at least if the bill can come to a vote. As I believe these the discharge petition rules work, if you file a bill and it languishes for 18 days without any sort of vote, then if a majority of House members sign on, they can force a vote. Therefore, Mike Johnson has included a section in the rule that is currently being debated in the House, which is a preliminary step to voting on the actual budget deal, that again declares in this rule that the rest of the House session until, I guess, the next election, I don't know, will be considered one single legislative day. Therefore, the clock cannot be run out on a discharge petition. There can't be 18 days because the entire legislative session is one long day. Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts on the House floor on Wednesday led the debate for an amendment to try and change this rule, to change that restriction.
I will offer an amendment. My amendment will simply strike Section 2 of the rule. That section, tucked in the rule by Republicans this morning, prevents the House from voting on Trump's disastrous worldwide tariffs. You know, the ones destroying the economy and raising prices on regular Americans. Just before I came down here, I guess Trump said on social media that he is partially pausing some of the reciprocal tariffs for 90 days. oh, cool, a 90-day pause. That is the certainty that the business community is looking for. How is any company supposed to forecast for their future? Hire workers if they have no idea what the hell this president is going to do in his next tweet. But we went from the president saying on social media today, be cool, to then saying, just kidding, we have a 90-day pause in a matter of hours. I mean, I have whiplash. I need a neck brace to be able to get through all of this.
I bet you do. I do, too. As another commenter on Blue Sky observed today, the entire reason you curb the exercise of arbitrary power is it prevents one a-hole's mood swings from wrecking an entire country. You don't praise it when it momentarily swings in your favor. Keep that in mind, even as I'm sure many people are happy to hear the news about what Trump did in the market on Wednesday. But wait until they notice the rest of what he did and how that is going to affect us.
Yeah, and remember, this is supposedly only a 90-day pause. So if you're a business, I don't know how you try to invest or plan any kind of, you know, capital expenditures or anything at all. With knowing that this could happen again in 90 days or maybe next week, who knows?
All power is unitary, writes Josh Marshall. What does this mean? Basically means that a political actor's relative power is the same everywhere. It's not divided up into separate buckets. You're not losing power on one front and maintaining or increasing it everywhere else. A win or loss on issue X redounds to the benefit or the loss of issue Y. An opposition cannot fight everywhere at once, but it does not necessarily have to. A loss on tariffs redounds to this effort in Congress. So keep up the good fight. We can't fight everywhere, but fight where you can because it matters everywhere else. All right, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can always download it for free at bradblog.com. That is a service made possible by you. Yes, you. Those of you, at least, who hit a donate button at Bradblog or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you in advance. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. And you'll find me at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.